County Sheriff's Posse Incorporated, which is a Texas nonprofit corporation. With me today is my partner, Belinda Breelink, who briefed this case. And also with me today is a lawyer from Cleburne, Mr. Buzz Dulick, who is the regular outside counsel for the Sheriff's Posse. This is a premises liability case, which I think presents two main questions for the court. The first question is whether Texas should adopt a new exception to the general rule that a lessor is not liable for harm occurring after commencement of the lease. Secondly, if the court should adopt this new exception, is the Sheriff's Posse nevertheless entitled to a summary judgment?
If we adopt Section 359, the restatement of torts, do you lose?
No, Your Honor.
For the second reason?
For the second reason. But back to the first question about whether the court should adopt. For decades, the general rule in Texas has been that the lessor is not liable for harm occurring after commencement of the lease. This arises from Restatement Section 356 and was cited with approval by the court in 1992 in the Brownsville Navigation District case. Now, Texas case law has for many decades recognized certain exceptions to this general rule. One case that lays these exceptions out fairly readably is the Wallace versus Horn case out of Corpus Christi in 1974. Those exceptions are when the lessor has a contract to repair the premises, when the lessor fraudulently conceals or fails to disclose hidden defects of which the landlord knows. Thirdly, when the landlord maintains control over the premises. And fourth, when there's a nuisance on the premises. Most of these exceptions are set forth in Restatement Sections 357 to 362. In this case, the Waco Court adopted the exception in Section 359, which the Corpus Christi Court refused to adopt in Wallace versus Horn. Section 359 applies when the premises are leased for purposes of admission of the public. It has three elements. First, the landlord must know or could discover that there is a condition that involves an unreasonable risk of harm. Second, the landlord has reason to expect that the tenant will admit the public before that harm is corrected. And thirdly, the landlord fails to exercise reasonable care to discover or remedy the harm.
Especially in the context of a short-term lease, let's say a party room or whatever, picnic grounds, what's wrong with the Restatement 359? Why doesn't that just make sense where the lessee, perhaps, who's in short-term possession is not in the best position to learn about unreasonable risks of harm present on the premises?
I think there are two reasons, Your Honor. First of all, is that I think the other exceptions cover the ground. The lessor contracts to repair the premises might be one exception. That would generally apply in a longer term lease. Secondly, where the landlord conceals some defect, that could clearly apply in a short term lease. Thirdly, where the landlord retains some control over the premises, and that can occur over part of the premises. The landlord doesn't necessarily have to relinquish control over the entire premises. It could be only over a portion. So over the portion that the landlord retains control, the landlord would still have the duty, even in the short-term lease context. The second reason, I think, is that the Section 359 is inconsistent with Texas law's emphasis on the right to control being the qualification for determining who has a duty. The cases almost uniformly talk about that the possessor with control of the premises is the one that owes the duty. Section 328E of the restatement defines the possessor of the premises in terms of the person who occupies or possesses the premises with intent to control it. So we always come back to the idea of control. And when the landlord relinquishes control, the landlord has no further duty. This court, in recent cases, has also emphasized the idea of control. In Centec Realty versus Siegler, Butcher versus Scott, both of which were decided last term, and Exxon versus Tidwell. And the control of the premises is basically the issue that the court came down to in those cases. So for these two reasons, I think it would be unwise and unnecessary for the court to adopt Section 359. Number one, the other exceptions control the ground. Number two, the emphasis on control would be inconsistent with adopting 359. Now, to focus a little bit more on your question, Justice Cornyn, I still think in a short-term lease that the superior right and duty to correct the problem still can lie with the lessee, because the lessee is the one who has accepted the premises, has entered the premises, and has invited the public onto the premises. And I think the court needs to consider whether it's wise to let the lessee in that situation off of the duty, because the lessee
is an either-or duty situation?
No, it wouldn't have to be, Your Honor.
And how come the lessee would not sue here? Is
the lessee
question more properly asked of someone else?
In this case, the lessees were two individuals who had an oral lease with the sheriff's posse. I can only speculate as to why they were not sued.
Judgment's true.
That'd be a good guess, but I don't know. The second question that I think this court can answer in this case is, if Section 359 does apply, if you decide to adopt it, the posse is still entitled to summary judgment. Section 359, as I said, has three elements. To be granted summary judgment, a defendant has to defeat only one element of a plaintiff's claim. In this case, element A is that the lessor knows or could discover that there's an unreasonable risk of harm. The alleged risk of harm in this case is a rock in the dirt floor of the arena. That is not an unreasonable risk of harm. In the Brownsville Navigation District case, this court addressed the situation where the trailer was sitting on dirt, and because of wet weather, the ground shifted and the trailer fell over. Court said that plain dirt, which becomes soft and muddy when wet, is not dangerous.
And part of your summary judgment is based on that theory?
Yes, Your Honor, that there is no unreasonable risk of harm in this case, because a rock in dirt is something you're going to have. And I think there's some evidence from one of the lessees, or maybe it's from the manager of the facility, that you're going to find rock in any dirt in any arena you go to, because rock is in dirt. Element B of Section 359 is that the lessor has reason to expect that the lessee will admit the public before the land is put in the safe condition. The evidence in this case is that the lessor and the lessee agreed that it was the lessee's obligation and duty to fix the arena premises, that is, the floor of the arena specifically, the way they wanted it. This is a multi-purpose arena used for many types of events, and each organization for each different event likes to have the floor done a different way. It needs to be a different way for a rodeo versus barrel riding versus a dog show versus a livestock show, or whatever the event might be. So the lessee is responsible for preparing the surface. The sheriff's posse even provides a tractor and tools for the purpose of the lessee to prepare the surface the way they want it to be prepared. So here the expectation was that the lessees would fix any conditions, any unsafe conditions, before the public was admitted to the arena.
Mr. Stolle, can the contractual arrangement between the lessor and lessee affect liability of the lessor to someone who gets injured on the property? I mean, the control factor, can that control factor be reallocated among the contracting parties, such as affects an injured person's claim?
I think it can, Your Honor, because in many cases that has occurred. Exxon versus Tidwell was a security case. Who had right to control the security, the landlord or the tenant? Centec Realty versus Siegler was the same thing.
Does it make any difference if those weren't premises liability cases? I mean, those were criminal activities on protecting someone from criminal activities.
But again, the issue was who had the right to control the premises. In this case, it's who has the right to control the physical condition of the premise. In your situation, Your Honor, it's who has the right to control the activity of third parties on the premises. But nevertheless, we still come down to right to control. The Court of Appeals in this case held that disregarding subsections A and B of Section 359, there's a fact issue on subsection C. Because there's a fact issue on subsection C, the summary judgment was improper. But as I said earlier, a defendant is entitled to summary judgment when that defendant defeats just one element of the plaintiff's claim. Posse has defeated elements A and B, and it doesn't matter that they have not defeated element C. So what the Court of Appeals has done in this case...
Is it and? A and B and C, or A or B or C?
It's conjunctive. It's A and B and C, Your Honor. So by defeating one of those elements, the posse defeats the claim under Section 359. The Court of Appeals logic would be akin to a negligence case where there's a fact issue on damages, fact issue on duty or breach of duty. And the court said, well, just because there's a fact issue on damages, we're going to let it be tried. But there's no fact issue on the other elements, so that's a proper summary judgment case, and so is this one, and that's a big hole in the Court of Appeals opinion as I see it. In conclusion, we ask that the court not adopt Section 359, but if you do, we ask that the court recognize that summary judgment is proper for the sheriff's office.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Ted Collins will present argument for respondent.
Thank you. I try to be brief. I think our brief is brief. Generally speaking, with respect to the argument regarding the summary judgment evidence itself, is whether or not there was sufficient evidence to create a fact question. The Court of Civil Appeals believes so. The argument right now, I believe, if I understand it correctly, is we demonstrated that we, being the petitioner, demonstrated to the court, trial court, that control of the dirt was absolutely within the lessees, therefore we win. I pointed out to the trial court and to the Court of Civil Appeals, and they apparently read it real well, the testimony of Tom Frank Jones as found in the deposition of Mr. Jones. And my citations are to certain pages in my brief here, 226, I believe, 223 to 226, something along that line, I think, for the court clerks can find it, but 223 to 226. I specifically asked Mr. Jones the question, can the lessees of the building bring their own dirt? His response was, no, of course not. We supply the dirt. We also supply them a tractor and a harrow to prepare the dirt with, and a water truck that they sometimes use. Now, in questioning Teresa McClendon in her deposition, which is set out here, she stated, arenas are prepared differently for different events that we use. Barrel racers would prefer the arena dirt be plowed deeper than team rollers or cap rollers.
If the presence of rock in the dirt in the arena doesn't present an unreasonable risk of harm, do you lose?
If as a matter of law it doesn't present?
An unreasonable risk of harm.
I probably must. I presented the affidavit of who I would consider the foremost expert in this area, Mr. Clem McSpadden, to the trial court. Mr. McSpadden's affidavit sets out that the presence, he concludes, the presence of rocks of any size in any rodeo arena is unreasonable. It presents an unreasonable risk of harm to not only the contestants, their animals, but to the spectators.
And Mr. Clear that it was a rock and not a clog?
If it's not clear, that was my client's assertion. There's been no summary judgment proof one way or the other. That would be a fact question.
But the actual, whatever it was, caused injury, is not an evidence.
It's not in evidence at this time. My client contends it was a rock. In his deposition, he gave some lengthy explanation of why he thought it was a rock. Nobody else thought it was anything else. Mr. McSpadden, his qualifications are set out in his affidavit, which was attached to the summary judgment. But just briefly, Mr. McSpadden went to school right here at the University of Texas, but he's from Oklahoma. He has been a rodeo announcer. He was the originator of the National Finals Rodeo along with Lex Conley. He managed the National Final Rodeo for years. He managed the All-Indian National Finals. He still manages the Lady E Arena for the Gaylord family in Oklahoma City. He was a state senator, a United States congressman, an unsuccessful candidate for governor of Oklahoma, and a graduate of UT Law School.
What particular job or endeavor or profession did he have in his expressive resume qualifies him as the renowned expert you claim him to be, that a rock would be an unreasonable harm, risk of harm?
He has managed the arenas for the national finals and has, as he stated over the years, determined that the presence of rocks in the arena could be propelled out of the arena to a spectator, could injure the animals, especially horses, by forcing it up into their foot.
We're speculating here that it was a rock.
And my client testified in his deposition it was a rock.
Assuming that it's a rock, how far can a horse throw a rock?
How far could he?
How far, I mean...
In a barrel race, I suppose he could hit the back wall.
Would it depend on the rock? A smaller rock would go farther, a larger rock would go not as far?
Well, I think a small rock may not go very far. From physics, there's a size of rock that would go farther than others. And it's probably, I would assume, a rock about this big. A little bitty one's not going to go very far. A great big one, he's not going to have the force to move.
To evaluate an unreasonable risk of harm, wouldn't you have to have somebody who would demonstrate that a certain size of rock with a certain horse hitting, somebody should know that a horse of a certain size running a certain speed would pick up a certain size of rock and throw it out of the arena? I mean, if we're going to talk about an unreasonable risk of harm, if that's the evaluation, simply saying it poses a risk because the animal could throw it, does that get you there? I mean, don't you have to?
Well, I would think under summary judgment proof, I prepare the affidavit from a man who is admittedly at least some sort of an expert, who says the presence of rocks of any size in a rodeo arena presents an unreasonable risk of harm to the animals, the spectators, and the participants.
Was your client a spectator?
Yes, ma'am.
And sitting in a stand?
Sitting in the grandstand. And what had happened, a barrel racer came out, made the first turn around the barrel. As she was turning the horse and heading for the next barrel, he was talking to someone at the time. He looked back up and he said, his eye turned black, he heard a thud behind him, like the sound of rocks hitting the back wall, and couldn't see out of that eye.
Is this case analogous to fans who are injured at sporting events like professional baseball, hit by a foul ball?
I would say not, because...
Why not?
In baseball, the spectator who comes to the arena knows that a ball can be hit out of there.
You're saying somebody that go to a rodeo, it's not...
I would assume. Let me say this. I spent many years rodeoing professionally. 12, 13 years. I did it for a living while I was in law school. I had no other job. 1 year in law school, I went to 87 rodeos across the United States, from right here from this law school.
You were not aware that you could be hit by a clod or some dirt?
A dirt clod? Sure. And I guarantee you, I never worried about it. But I never thought that there would be rocks in an indoor rodeo arena, or for that matter, an outdoor rodeo arena. But I never saw rocks in full throttle anywhere. I mean, I've been to every indoor arena that existed 20 years ago.
This in the record?
It's not in the record. I was just being asked.
According, it's an outdoor.
You got the wrong affidavit.
Well, Mr. Max Patton, he started out way ahead of me, and he participated in rodeos himself.
But doesn't sound like he was ever on the floor. He just was an announcer.
He was.
The Court of Appeals focused on control, and it only mentions unreasonable risk in the next to last paragraph, although it is a point of error in the application, and you do address it briefly in your response. Your view is that that whether there was an unreasonable risk here is an issue.
It's a fact issue.
That needs to be, that would have to be.
That would have to be resolved, and I think that would be fair.
Is the only evidence that it was a rock your client's testimony that he was hit by a rock?
That is correct.
But he didn't see it coming?
No, but
and
his testimony.
And all of a sudden he was hit, and then he couldn't see. How did he know it was a rock?
His testimony was that he was hit by an object in the eye. He said, I have been hit by a clod before, and it didn't feel like a clod. There was no dirt in my eye. I also heard something hit the tin wall 10 or 12 feet behind me, which sounded like either the rock that hit me or another rock. He said, I know the difference between a clod and a rock hitting a wall. That was his testimony. And there was no controversial testimony at all.
Does some cloth become rocks? Some cloth become rocks?
I don't think so. I guess you could heat a clod to the point that it would become a rock, but I don't know. That's a physics or a chemical question I'm not aware of. With respect to the adoption of Section 359 by the Court of Civil Appeals, or at least their reference to it and their statement it should be adopted, in my brief and in my original pleadings to the court, I have requested that the court hold that a party may not make available property to the public for a specific purpose, knowing that the property is unsafe for that purpose, and escape liability by merely stating that the lessee knew it was unsafe.
Well, is there any knowledge that the rodeo people knew, the property knew there was a rock in the
yes,
dirt?
In the testimony of Tom Frank Jones set out in this, which I made reference to in my brief, Tom Frank Jones says, yes, I'm sure there were rocks in the arena.
As a matter of curiosity, how do you ensure that there aren't any rocks in the dirt?
You sift the thing.
Through what?
You sift it.
Through what?
Oh, through a large thing about the size of this table. Go over the back of a dump truck that has wire mesh in it. I mean, it is actually done that way.
How deep?
This is not.
How deep do you go? I mean, 1 foot, 6 inches? You know, how? It's a lot of dirt we're talking about.
Most arenas have a cement floor on indoors. The exterior arenas, the outdoor arenas,
how about
you
this?
Hold. And this was an indoor arena. I do not know, though, and there was no testimony whether it had a cement floor or not. You would put 12, 14 inches. I've got a roping arena of my own, and I sifted the same. Right out here at Hutton. I'm worried about the horses. I'm not worried about spectators. But you sift it, and you can buy sifted sand. You could call your sandy loam dealer here in town, and for an extra $15 a truckload, a ton, you can get sifted sand. When they had the rodeo right over here at the Special Events Center, a client of mine, Tommy Steiner, was a rodeo producer. He required that Dean Justice, who was the owner of the building, or the manager for the university, provide the sand and sift it. And it was sifted sand, and it was moved out. They had that rodeo 2 or 3 years, and they kept that sand right out there. That's fairly common. And in your outdoor arenas, like Pecos, Texas, comes to mind, Burwell, Nebraska, they're big, huge arenas. They spent lots of time and effort trying to clean that sand and dirt. They take what is known as a rock picker. You see them a lot of times around racetracks. They run them over that dirt because rocks will build back up in there from the base. And they take it and sift it if they have to. Your racetrack people are worried about their horses and their jockey, but the rocks are a real problem. And the adoption of...
A rock in the sand poses an unreasonable risk to animals that are running across that sand.
That's correct.
But in terms of the likelihood of the animal picking up the rock and heaving the rock a distance necessary to catch a spectator someplace else is not the same type of risk that an animal faces when it runs across rocky ground, is it?
Probably the greater propensity would be for the animal to harm itself on that same rock. If you have a barrel race and there are any rocks in the sand around that barrel, it will be every time that horse turns that corner and starts out and kicks back with his hind feet, if there happens to be a rock in that pile of dirt, because he's not stirred as far as from here to the clerk over here, into the walls. And in this instance, you'll have a rail fence, and the spectators were probably half the distance between here and your clerk, because the back wall of that arena, I think, was only 14 feet away. The rock will be picked up every time. Every rock that is there that comes underneath a horse's foot that's turning it is going to be picked up and propelled some distance.
I don't have your pleadings, plaintiff's pleadings before me, but if I was to look at the pleadings, what would your allegation be with regards to what caused the damage? Would it say that it was a rock or small clump of dirt? Is that what the pleadings would show?
I think I said rock only, but I could have said rock or clod. I don't recall right now.
If it said a small clump of dirt, would it make a difference to your argument?
I would have. I probably wouldn't. If I thought it was a small clump of dirt, I would never file the lawsuit. My pleadings, here's a brief, at page 5 of my brief, I set out briefly what my pleadings stated. And that the appellant furnished the rodeo arena with a dirt floor containing rocks. That this condition was known to the appellee. That the presence of rocks is unsafe and presents an unreasonable risk. That appellee warranted that the arena was suitable for its intended purpose. That in fact it was not. That the appellee controlled the composition of the arena dirt. That appellant was injured as a result of a rock being thrown, and that the arena was leased for commercial purposes, and that appellant could have removed rock that they had in the past, which was the testimony of, I believe, their president, that at one time they sifted that thing, those rocks, when it was brought in.
At one point you were going to tell us why 359 is a good rule.
Well, I don't know that I was going that far, but what I had indicated was, as I said, the holding should be, and I think this is the Bruton case out of Washington is where I really came up with this, and I think I've cited in some case here or something I read this morning, but anyway, in that case, you had the leasing of a elk hall for a wedding reception, and at that reception, which was going to be for 2 hours, a lady was injured by falling down some stairs that were known to be dangerous by the landlord. The landlord in that case said, hey, I leased it to these people. Whoever the husband or wife, whoever was sponsoring the whatever function this was, I don't remember now with regard to the wedding, they should be liable. They were the ones in control of it. They should have repaired it. The Washington court said, that's ridiculous, completely unreasonable to expect people in that condition to do this.
But that's not really the facts here.
The facts here that
different types of groups with different needs rent this same arena.
These people rented the arena for
one or two hours.
That was the testimony. That was for a very short period, for one event, one night. That was it. They didn't have a long-term lease on the building. They would lease it about 3 or 4 times a year, they said, for one night. And the sheriff posse provided that same arena to other parties. I think on Wednesday nights they had a roping there. They had dog shows there. They had all kinds of other events, but they would lease it out to these people for a very short period of time. And I think it's extremely analogous.
Did I hear you say that it's not necessary for us to adopt Restatement Second of Torts, Section 359?
outright because you're arguing for a narrower?
I would think version. A narrower, or maybe I'm arguing for a more expanded version of it.
Well, I thought you said that Tom Frank Jones said that they knew there were rocks.
That's correct.
And so you're saying that they leased it, the posse leased it to the rodeo knowing there were rocks there.
That is correct.
And that's your theory of liability.
They knew there were rocks there. And they wished to escape liability by saying, so did the lessee, and the lessees could have removed the rocks with that harrowing tractor we provided. But as the court knows, I'm sure, what a harrow is, it's not going to remove any rocks.
Could they have brought other equipment to make the plane or the field suitable for their needs?
Realistically? No.
Practically, you know, they could go out and lease whatever equipment they need.
They could have gone out and sifted that rock dirt, probably at the cost of about $1,000, $1,500.
But there was nothing preventing them from doing that.
Time. Take 2 or 3 days. They leased it for a one-night affair a day before they did it, maybe 2 days before they did it. Sure, you know, all of that could be said. This court has said in the past, I believe in the David Al case, it's unreasonable in this time to believe that the lessee is going to, when you have really short-term leases, to make all the repairs. Those repairs should be imposed on the landlord. But especially...
So we ought to have a rule that whoever has these type of arenas should not lease, cannot lease, cannot enter into contracts of this nature unless they take it upon themselves to ensure that there will be no rocks or any unreasonable risks of any kind.
Or the Elks Lodge, ensure that there's no problem with their place. Or the Sheraton Hotel when the Bar Association leases for its annual function and somebody trips on the carpet. The people who are the public coming in there are the ones who are being told, look, you don't have any redress here. Number one, Bar Association's state agency. And they were in control and they leased it. You don't have any redress because the UIL leased the place and they're a state agency, and so what? You, the guy who had no idea that you were going to get hurt when you went in there, you, Mr. Public, are being told that's tough. Now, it's not, I think, if the lessee has a liability, fine. But the landlord should also have a liability because it's not practical for these lessees to correct that property in that short time frame.
Any other questions? Thank you, Grant. I thought you said in answer to one of my questions that your summary judgment evidence established that there were no unreasonable risks upon you. So that even if the court were to adopt 359, you would prevail.
Well, I think that's true, Your Honor.
That's contrary to what your brief says, though, doesn't it? Doesn't it make a concession that there's a, at least it says on page 12, for summary judgment purposes, you can see there's a dangerous condition, and that's brought under a discussion about 359 unreasonable compliance
standards. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I've forgotten about that. That's one of the arguments that Ms. Relink made in a point that this court did not grant the writ of error on. Contrary to what she wrote in the brief, I think just the pleadings themselves show that there was not an unreasonable risk upon.
Now, their pleadings cost this affidavit that Mr. McFadden filed?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe they do. They're touting Mr. McFadden as an expert. A former President Reagan claims to be a horseman. I don't care if it was him who was out here testifying as an expert witness. There's nobody who can add to the jury's knowledge in this case. An expert can testify only when he can add specialized knowledge that's beyond the jury's province. I think it's entirely within the jury's province to determine whether rocks in the dirt floor of an arena is an unreasonable risk of harm. and would not
need... That's within the jury's province. How do you establish it as a matter of law?
Because this court has done so in the Brownsville case. It said that the dirt was not, as a matter of law, was not an unreasonable risk of harm. And that this court, I think, implied... The dirt in that case, the allegation was that you didn't warn us that this dirt, when it gets wet, can cause the trailer to tip over. And there was, as far as I can tell from reading the case, there was no expert testimony about such things as what are the effects of different types of cargo or weight of cargo, what is the load-bearing capacity of the soil, what is the capacity at different levels of moisture. There was no evidence like that I can tell from reading the case. And this court decided as a matter of law that was not an unreasonable risk of harm.
Do you have a point of error in this court saying that as a matter of law that was not an unreasonable risk of harm?
I can't remember that we do, Your Honor. Probably not. It doesn't come to mind right now.
So to win in this court, if you don't have a point of error, or alternatively, if we don't adopt the view that we can disregard the affidavit as a matter of law, then we have to win by showing that we should not adopt 359.
No, we can still win on subpart B, Your Honor, that under 359, that the expectation was that the lessee would prepare the arena floor and make it safe before the public was admitted to the arena.
Does the summary judgment evidence show how long this oral lease was for?
The oral lease was for one day, but it was made 2 days before. And the evidence is that the lessee had that 2 days to observe the condition of the arena.
How much was, and it was a couple hundred bucks? Was
$200, John.
And do you know how much it would cost to eliminate all the rocks from the floor of the arena? I think counsel, I don't know whether it's in the record, I think counsel indicated it may be substantially more than that.
I have absolutely no idea, Your Honor. It's not in the record. Another point I would like to make is early in his argument, Mr. Holland mentioned what he believes the record states, that the lessee cannot bring dirt into the arena. Whether the lessee can bring dirt into the arena is not the issue. The issue is, could the lessee remove the rocks? And the answer to that question is yes. The testimony of the manager of the arena, Mr. Jones, was, who maintains the arena in terms of preparing the dirt in the indoor arena? Ever who we lease the arena to? They prepare it like they want it.
Any other questions? That concludes argument in this cause, and indeed all of the causes we've heard this morning. They are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal is now to adjourn the court.